that Football Focus doing? Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
As a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFF.
Do you not understand that they are that way because you're Joe Flacco?
You just like to discredit things that people deserve credit for.
That you can't possibly be expected to defend that.
Talk about the game, Sam.
So,
who cares about what people think about us?
Yeah, I like football. I like football season and all the things that go with it.
Welcome into the PFF NFL podcast. Steve Pelizzolo back here with Sam Monson with a ton of energy live here on a Monday morning talking all things NFL. We already have some players getting cut, and that's what we're going to focus on here today. Not so much the cuts, but the team building aspect, Sam. Potential trade, cut candidates, players on the move, and then just kind of recapping everything that just happened in the preseason. It's over. Regular season time.
Yeah, what we actually learned from the preseason now that it's done. Now that some teams have been forced to suffer through it with no intention of ever putting an important player near the field, what do we learn, Steve?
Well, we also learned that there are some injuries. J.K. Dobbins,
yeah,
injured, running back for the Ravens. We'll touch on that. Ja'Marr Chase has the yips, can't catch the ball. The Texans, I made this prediction to you through text message, but I was half joking that their crazy offseason of essentially signing a bunch of veterans who, with no long-term impact, they
sign
were just going to trade them all for draft picks. It seems like they might be doing that. And I think we need to get into your theory of two QB systems, because there's a few.
49ers did it.
Yes. And then there's a few teams who could legitimately do it. Patriots. And today on the Daily, we break down Mac Jones versus Cam Newton and what should happen there. So a lot to get to here today. Don't forget, over at PFF.com, though, all the grades from the preseason, every single player has been graded. Kickoff 30 is your promo code. You can get 30% off right now using kickoff 30, kickoff 30. I don't know how long this lasts. Do you know how long this lasts?
No.
But I would just get on it right now. So all the preseason grades, all the NFL grades, get ready for your fantasy season, all your fantasy tools for as little as $7 using kickoff 30, kickoff 30 at PFF.com. All right, you want to get into some potential trade and cut candidates here?
Let's do the preseason bit first. Let's
what we've learned.
Recap what we've learned.
All right. You want to start?
Yeah.
What have you learned in the preseason here?
That you shouldn't play starters. Don't do it. Don't risk them.
So that's what you've learned.
You played J.K. Dobbins for a series. Dude doesn't have an ACL anymore. Mistake. Error in judgment. You didn't have to chase the 20th preseason win that hard.
Can we have some sort of ceremony for the Ravens here?
It is the most incredibly...
20 straight.
I think they were talking to Ron Rivera or something because they were playing Washington for this game. And he was like, I mean, it's not important, but it's amazing.
Would you raise a banner?
No. And I think that kind of sums it up. Like, if you were trying to win every preseason game, it wouldn't be difficult to do, right? Because all you would need to do is just play your starters, and you win. Like, the second the team goes to the second team, which is usually earlier and earlier now, you have a massive advantage, and you're going to win the game. But the Ravens aren't doing that. Like, they're not consciously going out there saying, we must ensure we win these preseason games. They're just winning, playing the same way as everybody else. And at which point, winning 20 straight, given all the variances of second team, third team, and the craziness that happens, is ridiculous. It shouldn't be happening.
You know what that reminds me of course?
No.
The 2007 Instructional League Giants. Instructs. You know.
The what league?
Instructional League.
What?
So the end of the minor league season, you send guys to Instructs, the Instructional League, in the fall. All your top prospects, plus I got invited one year.
Uh-huh.
And the Giants, we went undefeated. What? 2007.
What is that?
It's like playing spring training games. So you just, it's like a month of spring training, but in the fall. So you just practice every day. You play games against, you know, the Cubs, the Angels, the A's in the area. And we just never lost.
Huh.
And then, you know, you started to see the fruits a few years later when the Giants won the World Series after they cut me.
Yeah,
it's the same thing, right? You just win an instructional league. Anyway, it's crazy. You're right, because they're not even trying to win. They're just stumbling into wins. I, I would love to, like, glean something from it. Like, oh, the Ravens always have the deepest roster. Maybe there's a little bit of truth in that, but
yeah, I mean,
it is ridiculous.
You probably can't do
2015,
that.
2015, we're talking, right? The last time they lost.
It's, an NFL record, all-time record now. You can't do that unless you have depth and decent coaching. And, like, it almost certainly is instructional in some way, shape, or form that endorses the Ravens. But it doesn't just mean that, you know, every single year they have by far the deepest roster and their second team could, you know, beat most team starters and all that kind of thing. It is just an incredible record, incredible run. Like, that might be harder to do than winning, like, going undefeated in the regular season. Winning that many straight preseason games when you consider all the extra craziness that gets heaped on board all these preseason games. But anyway, I started off this point of being, don't play starters.
But you're only looking at the one side of it. You're only looking at the results. Now, so you've just quantified the injury that you saw, the two injuries that you've seen. Now quantify the benefit of actually playing your starters and having them prepare for the regular
season.
There
isn't any. There's none.
Do that.
It's a figment of your imagination.
Prove
it's made
it.
Up. Well, last year, nobody played in their starters because there wasn't any preseason. Everyone was fine. This season,
I make that statement all the time too. But how do you know?
This season, a bunch of good teams haven't sent their starters anywhere near preseason, so we're going to find out. The Rams, not only did they not play any starters, any depth player of consequence hasn't been anywhere
near
the preseason. Their
top 45 didn't
see
the field.
So if the Rams stumble to like a 1-3 start, okay, we can talk. Otherwise, let's stop risking it. It's pointless to everybody. All you're doing is risking injury.
I am looking forward to seeing that. It was interesting because teams treated – here's one of the things I learned. Every team did something different in week three. So the old way of doing preseason was your starters might see a series in week one. All right, you got out there. Let's stay you know, healthy. Week two, you saw a little bit more. Then week three was the old dress rehearsal week, right? It's like, we're going to game plan. We're going to go through the half. We'll learn how to come out of the half. And you'll play almost either half plus, essentially, with your starters. And then week four was a lot like week one, which was get a series, and then let's go play football next week. Some teams used the third week of preseason, now that there's only three games. Some used it like the old week three, which was get the starters in. Like Josh Allen played a half.
Giants
Baker Mayfield finally played. The Giants played a lot. Tom Brady and the Bucks played a few series. I mean, so there's a lot of starters that played this past weekend. And then to your point, the Rams all the way through just didn't play starters. The Chargers, you know, we didn't see any Justin Herbert or, you know, the Bengals, of course, had a different situation with Joe Burrow. We just saw the, you know.
But other teams treated that third game as the one where, like, number two was the dress rehearsal. Number three was get everybody out of there.
Right. So two was the dress rehearsal. Like, the Dolphins didn't play Tua or, you know, their guys yesterday.
Yeah.
So it was just fascinating that stuff is all over the place.
But I think – and I think that probably speaks to what I'm saying. If there isn't a consensus about what to do here, it's probably not worth the risk. Because you are risking them by putting them out there. So unless you can prove pretty conclusively that there is a clear and obvious advantage to getting those guys game time, and it's not like you're getting them a lot of game time. Like, you are saying it is worth the one series you're putting them out there. It's worth risking the injuries, the ACLs, all those kinds of things. That's worth it for like five snaps. That feels like a tough sell. Now, if you're saying it's worth it for the full half to, you know, get the knock the rust off and get the experience and get everybody ready, okay, that makes a little bit of sense to me. But
so, like, you're either
Mike Davis was out there for one snap this preseason.
So you're either give him a whole half or keep him out of there. There's no in between there.
Yeah, I just don't see the point in this. Like, let's get the starters ready. Let's send them out for a series and then pull them back in and put them in cotton wool. Like, they should be put in cotton wool for the preseason, or give them some actual game time where they might get something of benefit. Like the first week for the Patriots, right? Cam Newton goes out there and plays the first series or two or whatever it was. But the first series or two went so badly for the offense that it was like six snaps and he was done. And it's like, well, he didn't play badly in those six snaps, but they didn't go anywhere and you saw nothing. So what did you get out of that? Like, now you're saying that just the exercise of doing it, just like getting into the pads and getting ready for game day, is somehow worth the injury risk that you expose Cam Newton and the offense to.
I mean, the other argument, though, is aren't you just as susceptible to injuries in practice, especially non-contact injuries?
I mean, maybe, but it's not either or. You're not practice or preseason. You're at the moment you're doing both. So don't do one of them.
Presumably, if you are not playing your starters in the preseason, presumably you want them to have X number of reps during that. That's the thing we don't see, right? So like last year, when we didn't have any preseason action, we have no idea how the rep count went.
But also preseason, I mean, practice reps with the way the CBA currently is are dramatically different from game full violence.
Yeah, but we've also talked
about... Nobody is hitting J.K. Dobbins the way he got hit in that game in practice.
True. I mean, I'm just saying, we've talked a lot about those joint practices and yeah, how important those
they're
are.
Controlled, they're better controlled environments. It's not the yeah, same level of full hitting. Like, J.K. Dobbins got sandwiched with a guy throwing his shoulder into his knee. That doesn't happen in practice reps.
So which
anymore.
Of your start? What about offensive linemen who do need reps? And you know, so I'm just looking at our grades. Kevin Dotson for the Steelers, 120 snaps this year. A guy that was kind of battling for a starting job, and you know, graded really well. Again, if you want those grades, pff.com, get your kickoff 30% off. Kevin Dotson, would you play him? A guy that's projected to start, but you know, kind of had to earn it.
Well, offensive line is tricky because you don't have that many players. So it's difficult to rest an entire starting five.
And they need to learn all communication preseason and everything.
Yeah, like there are positions where you're going to be forced into playing some players. There are also certain players that could use a preseason. But again, it's like play them the whole time or don't. Don't put them out there for four snaps and bring them in and go, right, job done. That's everything you're going to get out of this game. Like if you have a guy like Kevin Dotson who played well last season, very limited snaps, and you don't know 100% how good he is, or you're not, he could use experience generally. So play him all preseason.
All right. Well, other things we've learned this preseason. All five starting quarterbacks could be good. All the first five first rounders.
Yeah. Like, I don't know if people are talking about this enough. Like we're sort of focusing in on the individuals, right? Like each one of these guys looks good or what their situation is. When is it time to start talking about how good this draft class could be as
when
a
they
group?
Play in the regular season first.
Is it though?
Yes.
Is it?
Yes.
I think it might be now.
Let's do it now then. How good is this group going to be?
I was telling you yesterday that at one point in the pre-draft process, Adam Schefter tweeted that quarterbacks are going to go five of them are going to go in the first six picks. And it obviously didn't end up going that way. Two of them slid to one degree or other, but like maybe it should have. Like we're looking at these guys, and for a long time, because of the way the reports, the 49ers trade and the reports that they were interested in Mac Jones, the draft process became about tearing down Mac Jones and how he didn't belong in that top conversation and why he wasn't worth the number three overall pick. He looks like the best quarterback of the group right now. Now, what if all five of those guys are going to end up being good? Justin Fields is the one that I've had the most concerns with sort of all the way through, and I still liked Justin Fields from start to finish. And even watching him play, it's like, all right, the negative stuff is still there, but he might just be freaky enough that it doesn't matter. Like, he's going to work anyway, like with the accuracy and the size and the athleticism, and it might not always be conventional or orthodox or the way you want to see it. But if the dude is able to, like, run around past a defensive end and then just fire a ball into a closing window 30 yards away for a touchdown, who cares?
He did. I mean, Justin Fields did have one of the throws of the preseason, did it the other night. I mean, his game was okay up until that point, and I think that's what Fields brings. I'm a little surprised that he's doing so much outside the pocket, because I do think he likes to win.
But I think a big part of that is that line is just terrible. Like he almost has to at this point.
It hasn't been great. But to your point, we talked about how long he's holding on to the ball, like even a second longer than even some of the longest holding, you know, longest guys in the league. So it is going to look different. But his outside the pocket playmaking and speed, and we know the arm talent is there with Justin Fields. They're all just really intriguing. Trevor Lawrence, now he played the backups for the Cowboys yesterday. But even in previous games, again, there was at least one throw per game leading up to yesterday where it was like, wow, comeback route in his first game, touch throw over a linebacker, rolling to his left in the second game. And then yesterday, put it all together in an incredible effort. So, you know, like, Lawrence is looking as advertised as well.
Right. Lawrence hasn't been great generally over preseason, but he's the one that you're coming into the process with the highest degree of just money in the bank, right? Resume, you know, career track record. It's like, all right, we're pretty sure Trevor Lawrence is amazing. And if you see, that's one where there is something like everything gets sort of criticized in terms of bias for like reinforcing your priors. That's what preseason is, right?
Of course.
It's just about backing up your prior take or dismissing it if it doesn't fit your prior take. But there's something to the idea that like sometimes your prior take is the thing that you should be, it is the foundation piece you should be building things around. And, you know, when the data supports it, you should probably lean that way. And Trevor Lawrence is a good example, right? We've seen so much evidence that Trevor Lawrence is amazing so far that it only makes sense to like take the pieces that fit with that from preseason, add them into the picture, and kind of discard the stuff that didn't. Particularly when you can explain the stuff that didn't as, hey, half of his offensive line didn't start in the key game where he was looking sort of flustered and under pressure a little bit. So I think it does make sense to kind of reinforce your priors with what we've seen so far with Trevor Lawrence. But that's like, Trevor Lawrence hasn't played great. Trey Lance has made more mistakes than you would have expected, but he's also suffered from an insane amount of drops, and the talent is obvious. Like, the arm looks insane. He's made some really big plays.
I really wonder if the ball is just getting on Niners receivers so hot from Lance. I cannot believe how live his arm is. And I don't know if I'm being blinded by the fact that he also does throw everything 100 miles an hour.
Yeah.
It is like Baker. I mean, Baker had a point last year in those first 6 weeks or whenever when he was struggling, he would not put touch on anything. And Baker still struggles with that at times. Not that they don't have it. Not that it's not in their bag. It's just sometimes it's coming in too hot. Like Lance's pass on the goal line, everybody's like, oh, that's catchable. That's catchable. Like, yeah, on instant replay, it hit his hands, but it was like, it's like an 8-yard pass that is coming in 70 miles an hour, whatever it was. I do wonder how much you go from Garoppolo to Lance. Garoppolo's got an okay NFL arm. Lance's, the ball is flying out of his hand. I do wonder how much that's affecting those drops as well.
I do think there's something, I don't necessarily buy into the idea that if a guy fires it like a million miles an hour the whole time, that's automatically harder to catch. But I do think there's something to, if you're a receiver playing in practice and your rep can alternate between a guy with a cannon and a guy that doesn't.
It looks different, yeah.
Not just looks different, but it's like it feels different. It's right. Coming at you different. Like that, I think, can create drops. Way more than like if I'm only catching from the dude with the howitzer, you automatically adjust, right? That's just part of what you're dealing with. But if it alternates, and sometimes the howitzer is coming at you and sometimes, you know, Jake Fromm's pass is coming your way. Like the Bills receivers having to alternate from Josh Allen to Jake Fromm, that's ridiculous.
Not much different. I mean, can't get much more different.
Right. I can't even imagine how different the ball. Like if you're running the same route two times in a row in a drill and those are the two passes coming your way, it's like it's a completely different timing.
I'll save the baseball analogy.
Good, thank God.
But it's similar in baseball.
Of course it is, yeah.
When you have a slow pitcher and a fast
yoke. So I'm not saying,
as a hitter, it screws up the time.
I don't necessarily think that just the velocity that he's putting on the ball is causing that, but I think there might be something to the idea that going from Garoppolo to Trey Lance and back creates that.
So I think Trevor Lawrence has been as advertised. Zach Wilson, we've talked about, he didn't play at all this weekend, was just crisp and accurate, and you know, he made plays all over the place. Trey Lance, who we just mentioned, the Niners rolling out the 2QB system yesterday. We'll talk about that later. I do want to talk about the 2QB system legitimately. But Trey Lance, what we just discussed, rushing ability. He showed all the throws in the bag. Probably got to be a little bit more consistent, stop trying to throw the ball through defenders. He's been the most volatile of the rookies. Justin Fields probably the second most volatile of the rookies just because he's had some spectacular plays. Took that sack and against Buffalo, and
you made a great point yesterday though that he might have the worst situation of any of them,
and that's part of it as well, right? We said on draft day, right, Trey Lance has the best situation, Kyle Shanahan and the Niners, but yeah, Fields with the offensive line, many question marks about that, and then it's like Allen Robinson, Darnell Mooney's a good complimentary receiver. It's an okay group of playmakers with a star in
and
Allen Robinson.
And to be fair, he hasn't, like, they haven't really let him loose with the good group.
True.
You know what I mean? Like, it's the situation that's possible in Chicago, he hasn't had to play with yet. So we haven't really seen how good that situation is. The offensive line does look like a concern, whether it's the starters or the backups. But I think the receiving group would certainly get better if Fields got the chance with the ones that he hasn't had yet. But it is interesting that, like, none of these situations are terrible, which is, again, a help. Like, sometimes if you're talking about a really good draft class of quarterbacks, one or two of them are going to a train wreck of a situation, and you're like, those guys don't have a shot to be good year one because everything around them is a mess. You look at this group, there's nobody there that shouldn't be able to be good because of the situation around them. Jacksonville, all right, it's debatable given what we've seen so far and the relative lack of the exciting things that were promised so far. The Jets actually seem to have a pretty good situation all of a sudden. Chicago might be the worst, but as we say, at least the receivers get better when he plays with the ones. San Francisco is a great situation. The Patriots is a great situation. Like, none of these guys are going to be automatically prohibited from being good early because of what's around them.
I'm watching the Jaguars play and Trevor Lawrence, and I'm seeing how much the tight end looks like they could be involved. And Trevor Lawrence does a nice job throwing to the middle of the field and using the tight end, you know, from what I've seen. In the Jags, I know they just released Tim Tebow.
Yeah.
But they have one of the worst tight end rooms in the NFL. James O'Shaughnessy, who was targeted a few times yesterday. I mean, he's an okay backup tight end.
Which only goes to highlight, like, just how terrible a tight end Tim Tebow was.
Right, as expected, a 33-year-old in a new position.
Yeah.
But I'm looking at, you know, guys like Zach Ertz, who could be available, Hayden Hurst, who's backing up Kyle Pitts in Atlanta, O.J. Howard, who could be out and about and available for the Tampa Bay Bucs. I would love one of those guys. Any of those guys, I think, upgrade the Jaguars at tight end.
I mean, they
would be a really nice complement to everything else they have.
Whether O.J. Howard is in danger of getting cut or whether, like, Tampa Bay is just a team to call because they have so many, the Jags should definitely be, like, definitely be paying attention to Tampa Bay's tight end roster and
we'll
see
do
if
that.
They can get
we'll
one
do
of
that
those
later
guys.
As well. We'll do that later. I want to go through the potential players that are available, but yeah, I had to get that in there. Before we get into the rest of the rookie quarterback discussion, got to give a shout out to our friends over at Fantrax. Fantrax is free. Fantasy Football League Manager is the most customizable, easy to use, and feature rich platform in the entire industry. And PFF is gearing up to play our leagues on Fantrax this season. They feature multi-team trades, bonus points for touchdowns of different yardage. And if you're coming from another site, it's not a problem. Fantrax can import any of your leagues completely free. So create a free account now using promo code PFF at Fantrax.com/PFF. Get a chance to win a trip to any regular season game this year for you and your entire league plus $6,000. It's promo code PFF at Fantrax.com/PFF. Just to wrap it up on the QB discussion, we discussed Fields. And as we said, Mac Jones. We got into the Mac Jones-Cam Newton discussion in depth on the PFF Daily this morning. I still want to give away PFF Edge subscriptions. So if you are not subscribed to the PFF NFL Daily, pause right now. Go subscribe or just get on your phone. Go click subscribe. Send us a screenshot that you're subscribed to both the Daily and this, the NFL podcast, and we'll give away a free PFF Edge subscription once I get 25 more entries. 25 more entries.
Whew.
That should be easy, right? We've already had thousands out of our millions of listeners. But subscribe to the Daily and go listen to the Mac Jones, Cam Newton debate. But Mac Jones looked really good. So all five have legitimately looked really good.
And look, we keep sort of saying that, hey, the odds are one or two of these guys busts because that's just the way the NFL is. The draft classes never have that kind of strike rate. And the odds still remain that way. We've only seen preseason, right? The odds are some of these guys are going to get to the regular season, things are going to change, and all of a sudden one or two of them don't look as good. But just for a second, imagine a world where that isn't the case. And the level that these guys look like they're capable of attaining is where they're going to hit. If all five of these guys actually hit, this becomes the best draft class of quarterbacks in decades. Like, since that 83, which year was it? The Marino, Kelly, like that class.
I just want to bring some perspective to the table here. In 2018, there were the five rookie first-round quarterbacks. Now, what was perception? That's the Baker Mayfield, Josh Allen, Lamar class. Baker had an 81.4 PFF grade. I think he was impressive in the preseason. He showed he was enough to get excited about in the preseason. Sam Darnold had the second best grade out of that group
as a
with
rookie.
A 74.8 as a rookie in preseason as a rookie. So I'm just trying to compare it to this group of quarterbacks as rookies. Darnold, remember he started his first ever throw as a pick six against the Lions, and then he was actually really pretty good after that. He only averaged 5.4 yards per attempt, but the grade wasn't bad. Josh Allen had a 65 grade, which actually was a precursor to his first two regular seasons where he had 65 grades in each of those years. Lamar Jackson had a 60 grade and only a 52 passing grade. Even the stats weren't great. 77 passer rating, 6 yards per attempt. He did show the rushing ability, though, of course. And then Josh Rosen had a 46 grade. So coming out of that, of those, we had those five first-round quarterbacks. We clearly weren't talking up Josh Rosen at the time. And then he gets into the regular season, and it was bad all the way through. Bad situation in Arizona. Lamar Jackson showed off some of what he would eventually become, but it was like, okay, still needs a lot of polish as a passer. Josh Allen still, I remember he had this cover two shot. It's like, oh, there's the arm, but he still needed polish as a passer. And it was Baker and Darnold that I think probably, and they were the first two off the board, they felt the best coming out of there. But it was those two. You saw the same stuff from Allen and Lamar, and you didn't feel great about Josh Rosen. It's a different feeling. And then ultimately we saw Baker, Josh Allen, and Lamar Jackson are the three legitimate starters out of that group. Sam Darnold still has a shot this year, and Josh Rosen's been with like 12 teams.
But that's like, that is the best quarterback class in terms of a group of however many in the first round for a long time, that 2018 class.
Right.
And even that class pre-draft, there was a lot of people talking up Baker Mayfield, of which we were driving the bandwagon, so it's difficult to kind of separate yourself in terms of where everybody else was. There were a lot of people saying Darnold was the number one pick. The people that loved Josh Allen loved him enough to be saying he was in that top conversation as well.
Sure.
Not as many people pushing Rosen for that group. And then there were some like Lamar stans, but generally the consensus was he was a lower prospect than the rest. So I don't think there was a point in time where everybody was saying, hey, five quarterbacks could go in the first six picks, right? So even pre-draft, that class was not quite where this one is in terms of hype. So again, like, if that's the best since that ridiculous Marino class, I'm just saying, if this group pans out the way they are, we are talking about a truly generational group of players. Like a generational in the real sense of the word, as opposed to the hyperbole sense that gets used every 2 minutes. Like, even beyond generational, what, 83? Was that draft class?
I think to be generational, though, they need to be really good. So are these guys just going to be capable starters, or do you think they're all going to be?
But if five of them are just, like, capable starters, that puts it in that category.
True, but I also wonder how that meshes with the league, which I hate repeating myself 1,000 times here, but the league, which has a plethora of capable starters. And they're filling in the teams that don't have one, and they're filling in spots.
But
I kind of think
that just by the law of averages, like if five of them become capable starters, at least one of them is going to be really good.
No, I agree. So what I'm interested in is how many of these guys fill in that hypothetical top eight quarterbacks that does feel like it gives you that.
How many of them are above the Matt Ryan inflection?
Yes,
point?
Who are above the Matt Ryan inflection point? Yeah. You want to make a prediction on that?
How many or who?
Both.
One is above because...
Trevor.
No.
Trevor's not going to be above the Matt Ryan inflection point?
No.
I'm not saying immediately. I'm saying like within 3 years.
No.
Trevor Lawrence is not going to be a top eight quarterback in the NFL.
He's not going to be above the Matt Ryan inflection point.
Oh, wow. You're
That's
crazy.
My prediction.
I think there's two of them.
Zach Wilson will.
Yeah.
Mac Jones will.
You're all Mac Jones. You're team Mac
Jones. I'm bought in. I've reassessed. I went back and I wrote a piece at some point in the pre-draft process when everybody was tearing him down during the he's not worth number three overall stuff. And I was like, basically looked at, look, obviously he's no kind of athletic, no kind of outside of the pocket athletic ability, right? But is what he's good at good enough to ignore all that and say he can still be really good? And in the article, I came to the conclusion that, yeah, I think he is, but would I be willing to bet three first-round picks on it, which is essentially what the 49ers would be doing if they drafted him number three? And I was like, no. So I think my point essentially was that I think he's worth number three overall, but not if you've had to come from number 12 to do that. You know what I mean?
Right.
If you were already picking number three, I would take the pick and spend it on Mac Jones and be confident enough that he's good enough at the stuff that he's amazing at, that it's worth it. If I've come from number 12 and I've thrown three first round picks at this, I'm not that confident. I don't buy into it enough. But when you look at, this was there, like this was all in evidence in his tape, that he isn't just this product of an Alabama offense where he just goes in there, it's idiot proof, he doesn't have to do anything, all he has to do is like throw the ball to a wide open guy every play. Obviously that helped and that was part of it, but his ability to command that offense and to correctly diagnose what he was looking at and to put the ball where it needed to go quickly to the right target every single play was the best of anybody in this draft class, including Trevor Lawrence, including Zach Wilson. Like, it was amazing. And that is still there. And even when he's playing with the twos and under more duress and throwing to guys that aren't as good, it's still obvious.
I think the one thing to remember there in the Trey Lance, Mac Jones debate, and this is why it's a little bit like the Penei Sewell, Jamar Chase thing, for whatever that's worth, where it felt like there was no wrong answer, right? Mac Jones is about to become 23 years old, and Trey Lance is only 21. I mean, there is a difference in those 2 years where Trey Lance has shown all of these skills and these tools, and it doesn't mean that you're automatically going to progress the same rate and all that stuff, but there is something intriguing about Trey Lance being a little bit more moldable, of course having the athletic ability, of course having the incredible arm strength. And I use the, you know, flashed enough accuracy. Accuracy is more of a binary, like yes or no. But just like Lamar had special throws on tape. He just also missed a lot too. Well, Trey Lance is similar.
He's Cam right now in terms of accuracy. It's like if you want to pull up a highlight reel of him putting pinpoint passes on guys, it looks incredible. But the question is, where is that going to land in terms of frequency? Can you do that every single play?
Right.
Or are you going to do that every now and again? And then you're going to have a bunch of misses in between. Right now, he's on that Cam spectrum of, like, overall, your accuracy isn't great, but when you nail it, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think there's a fair enough argument for both. Like, Trey Lance is only 21, and again, Sam Darnold came out at 21. It doesn't always mean you're just going to progress.
His ceiling is still incredible, and he's in a great offense. And we saw yesterday that, hey, when Shanahan delves into the bag of tricks, it's fun. Like, that... The idea that we've been talking about, you know, when they drafted him, that, hey, what Shanahan is going to be able to create using Trey Lance within this offense is going to be indefensible. It's going to be impossible to stop. That we saw some of that for the first time yesterday. So I still think Trey Lance is in a fantastic situation, and his ceiling is insane, but I'm less confident that he'll attain it than I am that Mac Jones will attain his.
Yeah, it's okay to have patience. It's okay to...
No,
to have patience with
not
Trey
today's
Lance.
World, Steve.
I think Lawrence and Wilson get into that top eight conversation.
Lawrence and Wilson.
Trevor Lawrence, Zach Wilson, the top two picks.
Yeah.
But man, I could see any of them doing it.
Yeah.
I really can. I could see the path for all of them.
Yeah, none of the five I would rule out in terms of having that ability.
Here's another way of looking at it. I would say Carson Wentz. So you have Carson Wentz, Jared Goff, and Dak Prescott. I think Dak has certainly become, in that 2016 class, Dak has become the best of that group.
Yeah.
That has not been clearly defined until probably the last year, though.
Yep.
Right? And I famously go back and I say, the first year, Carson Wentz had the highest... Dak had the highest grade their first year. Then it was Goff. I'm sorry, then it was Wentz. Then it was Goff.
Yep.
2019 was Dak. And then 2020 was Dak before he got hurt. Right? So right. it really rotated, right?
Yeah.
This class could have a lot of similarities.
Which is also the way it's been with the 2018 group.
And
Baker,
I said coming out in 2018, Josh I was Allen. Like, if you gave me 10 years, I would predict Baker to be the highest graded guy in eight of them.
Right.
So I might have been a little extreme there. But
well, you just need a run of seven straight.
Yeah, he's still kind of got it in play. But yeah, we've had Baker as the highest graded. We've had Lamar, and we've had Josh Allen. Right? So it's not this – other than Mahomes in 2017, it's not really this linear ranking of quarterbacks. But my point on Wentz and Goff – In Dak, they rotated, but they were all top 15 quarterbacks, I think, for the majority of their career, depending on where the league is. These five first-rounders could all land in that top 15.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just incredibly impressed. It's only preseason, right? So we're getting way ahead of ourselves. But I'm incredibly impressed by this group as a whole. None of the five do you look at through preseason and are concerned about and think, oh, this guy is sort of headed towards an uncomfortable place. And all five of them you look at and you say, any of these five could be above that Matt Ryan inflection point for their careers. This could be a truly special group of quarterbacks, which is why it's so interesting that, like, pre-draft process was spent tearing down at least one of them.
If I tweeted, good morning, PFF, just going head-to-head, good morning, football.
Oh, as opposed to good morning, comma, at PFF.
Good morning, PFF.
Thought you were going to wish
the
main.
This could be the name of our Monday morning show.
Yeah, I thought you were wishing the main account a good morning.
No, I wasn't going to speak to them directly. Okay. Do you, with Nate Burleson moving on from Good Morning Football, do you think we could?
You think you could get in there?
No. I've already been on the show, Sam. Yeah. I've already been on the show.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's a natural segue.
There's like too much acting involved in that. They do a lot of, segments where they dress up.
But that's what Kyle's there for. You could be the straight guy.
The no acting?
Yeah.
No emotion guy?
Right. Deadpan.
I don't think people like that.
No?
I don't think people.
I think it'd be worth putting you on there just to get the visual of you next to Kay all the time.
True. I mean, she's like...
I mean, I'm all for that, generally, as a concept.
She's a lot shorter than me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just saying, I think we could compete with them in a ratings war.
Okay.
Mondays.
On Mondays.
We can't do every day.
No, God, no.
But just Monday morning.
That's a lot of early mornings.
At 7 a.m. Any other things you learned in the preseason?
Well, so I'm curious. We should need to talk about Gardner Minshew. Gardner Minshew gets traded for basically a bag of peanuts to the Philadelphia Eagles. I'm very fascinated by the fact that half the league was not more interested in Minshew than that. It's, what is it, a conditional sixth or something insane that they traded for him? How? Dallas. Dallas is about to roll into the season with Dak Prescott coming off an injury and potentially going through more injuries, right? Maurice Jones-Drew on the show last night on NFL Network was saying that, hey, one year, I being MJD as opposed to me, I am speaking in the voice of MJD.
I understand.
Now. He was saying that, look, one year I was rehabbing all offseason from a foot injury, and it meant that I couldn't do like my usual offseason workout routine and train the way I normally do. And that year was just a nightmare for injuries because everything was less than where it should be, and you were compensating from one thing on the rehab, and just like I had a whole sequence of stuff that fell apart that year. Bad year, terrible. And his speculation was that that's what we're dealing with Dak right now. He's just spent the last, year rehabbing his ankle, and now you're seeing his shoulder start to tweak and various things that are not where they should be because of all the rehab he's been doing on his ankle. And you're just going to spend like a year suffering through these minor niggles, and that's going to like keep him from being the player that he's supposed to be. Whether or not that's true, you are looking at a player now that's had one major injury, is dealing with something else, and you should, at the very minimum, be countenancing what his backup looks like. And right now, his backup is a three-way competition between Garrett Gilbert, who, God, I love the guy, but look, it's not gone well for Garrett since he's come back into the NFL. Cooper Rush, and Ben DiNucci. And even though it's been preseason and there's been no reason not to have him on the roster, I still am amazed that that guy has hung on to a roster given what he's done in the NFL so far. How is Dallas not willing to throw a fifth-round pick at the Jags for Minshew?
How do you know they're not?
Well, they didn't.
I mean, they may have.
But they didn't. He went to Philly for less than that.
Then less than a sixth?
I said, why? If he went for a sixth,
throw a regular
conditional
sixth. Throw a real
why
sixth.
Was Dallas not willing to go to a conditional five?
No, it's a good question. I mean, I think Dallas should be looking at somebody like Nick Foles or something.
Half the league is in this situation, right? Dallas, Minnesota right now has no viable backup outside of Kirk Cousins. Like, there are a lot of teams for whom Gardner Minshew becomes a clear upgrade at backup quarterback, and evidently it didn't cost much to make that happen.
I'm torn on Minshew as a player because we've been on here before. I've been very impressed with what he did, obviously as a sixth-round pick. But what he did, and in a situation, right? I mean, trying to separate your quarterback from the situation is important. And he put up numbers. He put up good, solid numbers. He graded pretty well, 70 and 67. I went back. I was trying to think. Actually, Mike Glennon's first 2 years are similar. The grades are a little bit lower, 64 and 66 for Mike Glennon. But you're talking about a third-round pick in Glennon, The difference is this perceived upside, probably. I think people still think Mike Glennon has a great arm because he's 6'6", 225. He's got an okay, and he's got a pretty good arm, right? Just be like, people still think Brock Osweiler has a good arm. He has a below-average NFL arm, velocity-wise, even though he's 6'7". So Mike Glennon isn't a toolsy guy. Gardner Minshew isn't a toolsy guy. But both guys produced in just, you know, okay situations, which is intriguing to me. And so I think the floor for Minshew is high-end backup. I mean, like Case Keenum plus high-end backup. But when you put him, I'd be intrigued by him in a good situation. Minshew's not perfect, right? He's almost one-to-one big-time throws to turnover-worthy plays and all that stuff. But again, not the best receiving core in the world, not the best offensive line in the world. Like, I want that on my team. Like, Jacksonville could use a backup quarterback. Yes. I know C.J. Beathard just tore it up this preseason, and he's got experience. And Beathard's an okay backup. He's fine. But I also don't think the Jags needed to just push Minshew out the door either.
Particularly given his contract. Like, it's not like he's – you aren't saddled with this giant contract of your previous starting quarterback. Like, he
was – at worst, hold on to him for a couple of years.
Right. He was a bargain anyway. So, yeah, I mean, I kind of get it from Jacksonville's point of view of, hey, look, clean start, break – let's make sure the rookie isn't looking over his shoulder for whatever that's worth. Okay, fine. Just to clarify, the deal is a conditional sixth-round pick that can be upgraded to a fifth round. I think it was something like if he plays...
It's 50% or something.
But only in like three games or something. Like he only has to have like three starts of... Essentially three starts. But anyway, the point is, like, maximum this deal can go to is a fifth-round pick. There are half a dozen teams in the NFL that should have been willing to throw a fifth-round pick at Jacksonville for Minshew, even if all you're thinking about is your backup quarterback situation. And I agree that, hey, look, Minshew's floor is decent backup. His ceiling, I mean, it could be marginal starter still. Like, he might still be an okay starter if the situation is good enough. Now, that's not necessarily something you're going targeting, you know, as a team, but having that as a contingency is pretty good.
Like, Gardner Minshew has... If he put together a Jimmy Garoppolo type of season in the right situation with a good supporting cast, here's what that is. Garoppolo graded in the high 70s in 2018, number 13 in the NFL, and they go to a Super Bowl. Is Gardner Minshew capable of that?
What would Minshew look like in a Kyle Shanahan offense if it was with the talent around him being good?
What he needs to improve upon is he tries to play hero ball too much. He tries to do a little bit too much outside of structure. A lot of his turnover-worthy plays have been fumbles. And I think that's the most intriguing thing to me is I'm not saying, hey, oh, that's a good thing you're fumbling. I feel like that's easier to correct than, say, Jordan Love. I mean, I guess this is kind of easy to correct. Jordan Love has some of the ugliest turnover-worthy plays.
Just stop throwing the ball in double coverage off your
Jordan
back foot.
Jordan Love keeps throwing back foot, you know, prayers into double coverage.
Yeah.
That are just ridiculous. I do feel like that's like Jordan. Just don't do that.
You know, I don't think that's fixable. I don't. I don't think that is. If you,
but that's
if
like
in your mind's
playing,
eye.
That's not. To me, there's a difference between reading coverage. Jordan Love's not misreading coverage here. Gardner Minshew's not misreading coverage. He's just something innate in him is saying, I got to make a play here.
But if in your mind's eye during the play you look up and you think that's on. That's a shot I can take. I can get it there.
That.
Right. If you're like looking at that and you're going, I can get it there. And you repeatedly start taking those. I don't think you can dial that. I don't think you can change that. That's like in a guy's brain and it's done.
There's another guy who used to do that. You know how he fixed it? LASIK.
Yeah.
Maybe Minshew. Maybe Love needs LASIK.
Maybe.
Minshew, I don't know, because he just is dancing around the pocket and all that stuff.
Let's talk Jameis then. LASIK fixed him.
I mean,
that's what we learned from preseason?
Yeah.
Okay. Do we think that's actually true, or do we just get like 30 snaps of high-end Jameis?
No. I will say his deep – so Lewis Riddick sometimes gets, you know, sees camp and all that stuff, and he thinks the Saints' deep passing game is going to be excellent, which 3 weeks ago sounded crazy on paper. So first off, what I learned in the preseason is I think Marquez Callaway is legit.
Yes.
I thought he was a good maybe 2/3 potentially – he might be a legitimate one. And when Michael Thomas does come back, I feel really good about those guys. So if you guys just listened to our NFC South preview a few weeks ago and I'm trashing the Saints.
Change everything.
Core,
yeah.
I have turned around a little bit and I think they at least have Callaway. And that pushes the other guys down from an expectation standpoint. Traquan and Devonta Harris. Mentioned Juwan Johnson a few times on this show, converting to tight end, who could be an intriguing option. So I think I feel better about that group. I don't know if Jameis is fixed, but he's been an intermediate threat. He's been that 10 to 19 range, up to 25, you know, deep outs and post and all that stuff. He was great deep ball a couple times.
But that's the...
And that's a depth perception thing, so I don't know.
Stop.
Maybe.
Depth perception thing.
I'm saying that's what that is. There's something... There's like the visual of where players are and getting it there. And look. Jameis... I've seen Jameis play incredible football.
Yeah.
Incredible football.
Right. For
but
how long?
2013.
Yeah. And for how long?
A season. 8 games is his redshirt freshman season was the best I've ever seen Jameis play.
Right. That's like his high end. Right now, for this preseason, we are dealing with 23 dropbacks of Jameis.
Yeah.
And we're proclaiming him fixed because he had LASIK. And then he had LASIK and what? Then 23
Nobody's
dropbacks.
Claiming him fixed.
People are genuinely claiming him fixed because of the LASIK. It's like, oh, he couldn't see when he was throwing 30 interceptions.
That's why we're here to just unpack the narratives.
Look,
here.
I think that Callaway emerging as a true star receiver, and it wasn't just like those two deep touchdowns were incredible plays from Callaway, not just because he got open deep and made the catch, because of how he was doing it. Like, he fought off contact at the catch point both times, hauled it in. But he was also catching stuff underneath as well. Like, he looks like a legit number one receiver that can get open at all levels of the defense and make plays. That, I think, changes the dynamic of who should be at quarterback. If you didn't have any wide receivers, I think there's something to the idea that you put Taysom Hill in and pivot completely what kind of offense you're going to run. Run heavy, manufacture open targets as opposed to relying on them being open in the first place. If you actually have a receiver that can get open deep, Jameis is the guy with the proven deep ball. Like, Taysom Hill still hasn't shown yet that he can actually deliver that pass on time 40 yards downfield as opposed to underthrown and waiting on it.
Right.
If that is an option, then suddenly I think, yeah, Jameis Winston becomes the guy you put in there. But the idea that he had LASIK and then 23 dropbacks at a 90-plus grade and now he's fixed is just not understanding sample sizes and variance. Like, we're dealing with one of the most volatile quarterbacks in the NFL. There are probably a dozen stretches of his career where he has had 23 dropbacks of a 90-plus PFF grade, and then it always comes down the other side again.
Thank you for
now the question
bringing us back down to earth.
Well, now the question becomes, does he come back down to earth, or is Sean Payton capable of, like, eliminating those bad plays?
I'm more of the mind when I saw – it's not that Jameis has become a 90-plus quarterback. It's just that I saw the Sean Payton offense look like Sean Payton's offense in limited time, you know, seam route here and there. Forget the deep ball stuff. I mean, those are the highlight reel plays. It looked crisp. It looked effective. It looks like Jameis gives them the best opportunity, and I'm intrigued by that. And I'm more intrigued by Callaway, who was fine. He was solid last year as an undrafted rookie, 68 receiving grade, was only used – average depth of target was only about 8. So he was used in more of a possession role in an offense that did not throw the ball down the field a lot. So at the very least, when you have a Jameis and you have a guy like Callaway who's really good at the catch point, he's going to have a ton of opportunities. And again, it's Jameis's volatility that's almost the most intriguing thing. It's what the high end could bring in his aggressiveness. And I really can't wait to see that mesh with Sean Payton. I'm a little bit more confident in it now in the preseason than I was in the offseason.
Yeah, look, I don't think that Jameis is fixed. But the other intriguing part about all this is Jameis is definitely a worse quarterback than Drew Brees was, even at the end. But the fact that Jameis has that deep ball and will threaten the intermediate level and will essentially will stress a defense at all levels on any given play is something that the Saints haven't had for the last year and a half of Drew Brees.
Right.
Whatever the reason, whether it was just Drew Brees getting old, whether it was 11 broken ribs and everything else he was battling through last year, Drew Brees simply was not threatening various levels of the defense on any given play last year at all. Like, you didn't need to worry about it. If you were playing backside cover 3, switch off, you're done. Drew Brees isn't getting it over here. Right. Like, it doesn't matter what happens in the play.
There were noticeably open passes that Brees was passing.
Exactly. Because he just couldn't get the ball there. And that's fine because he was still good. Like, he still understood where to go with the ball. He was still accurate enough, even if the ball would die before it got there. The fact that Jameis puts those areas of the field back in play again is an important element to this whole thing. Like, he will be worse. He will make more mistakes, but he will also change what a defense has to concern itself with every single snap. And that, I think, is an important and, like, under-discussed element of Jameis Winston succeeding Drew Brees.
Here's the thing with the way I described Baker Mayfield last year, when he was playing with Freddie Kitchens, there weren't a lot of gimme throws in the 2019 offense. It was intriguing in as a rookie. It was like, well, Freddie Kitchens, boy genius, you know, as an offensive coordinator. 19 didn't feel that way. It felt like everything was on Baker and offensive line was bad. Last year when Stefanski came in, I said, there's going to be enough throws where it's like an easy rollout, some screens and all that stuff, take something off Baker's plate. Can you do that with Jameis? Because Peyton can do that. Because Drew Brees threw to his running backs as much as any quarterback in the NFL. And that doesn't mean you're just dinking and – I mean, Brees was on the lower end of average depth of target, but there was a lot of checkdowns when necessary. It was 5. A screen 8, game.
Or 6.6 yards for
– Last year was very dink and dunk for anybody. But my point is the running backs were a big part of that offense. Can you get Jameis to have that balance? How do you balance that? And so if – again, if he drops back 35 times, if 10 to 15 of those are schemed up, right, if they're screens, if there are a couple rollouts here and there, if it's you know, just getting to the check down at the right time. And then the other 15 or 20, it's Jameis, it's third and long, go be that guy. Read it out, get to where you need to go. Like, he's capable of doing that, but you just got to take some of those reads off his plate. Because if you make Jameis make 40 good decisions over and over and over again, history showed us 2 to 4 of them are going to be bad ones, and that's way more than what they're used to.
Yeah.
And that's where it gets dangerous.
Right. But I'm just intrigued by the balance in terms of even if he stays as prone to bad mistakes as he's always been. Now, this is a guy with a career turnover-worthy play rate of 4.8%, which is huge.
If you just drop that into a season, it would be bottom 5, bottom 6.
It's a massive figure. Like, it's double what a quarterback should be approaching. Like, the best quarterbacks in the NFL last season were under 2%. So to be 4.8 for your career is just massive. But even if he stays there, again, like the fact that you are putting the entire field back in play every single snap with Sean Payton at the helm exploiting that, I think is a really under-talked about part of this whole dynamic. Then if you can move that percentage a little bit, not eliminate it, not put him at the top end, but again, just cut it down and put him in the middle somewhere. Get it to 3.5%, like, which is still not good, but it's a massive difference between 4.8 and that.
While opening up the parts of the field that you, as you say, have not been there. I'm intrigued. I'm intrigued by the Saints. We've come full circle on all the teams that were overrated months ago, the Saints and the Steelers and the whole thing. The NFL's back, as we know. DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL, is giving all new players a can't-miss offer for week one. You bet just $1 on any NFL game during the first week of the season, and guess what you get? $200 in free bets instantly, no matter what. Take advantage of this limited-time offer now. You heard it right. DraftKings is giving all new players $200 in free bets instantly when you place a bet of just $1 or more on any week one game. Head to DraftKings Sportsbook app now and check out all the great promotions and daily odds boosts. Plus, you can make every game a big game with same-game parlays. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now. Use promo code PFF to receive $200 in free bets when you place a $1 bet on any week one game. That's promo code PFF to get your free $200 in free bets instantly for a limited time only at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. Must be 21 or older, New Jersey, Indiana, Pennsylvania only, new customers only. Restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com/sportsbook for details. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or in Indiana, 1-800-9-WITH-IT. How difficult is it for Indiana to just roll with 1-800-GAMBLER as their hotline?
Maybe somebody claimed it. You know, you get like a website domain squatters.
You think that's what happened in Indiana?
Maybe somebody grabbed the phone number.
Should we be doing that? Should we grab 1-800-GAMBLER across all the different regions?
They're opening up at some point, right? We grab it?
You assume every state's going to open up at some point. We got to grab 1-800-GAMBLER.
Everywhere.
So what's going to happen when there's 50 states and there's 35 different hotlines? I have to read all of those?
I don't know.
Go to DraftKings.com. Take advantage of that. That was going to be my last preseason takeaway. I'm a believer in the Steelers now all of a sudden.
Oh, yeah?
I don't know. I mean, I think.
Define believer.
It was easy to think that the Steelers were going to be a train wreck this year, right? And I even made the point when we were saying that they were going to be a train wreck. The offensive line looks bad. They drafted a running back in the first round. Big Ben's coming off his worst season of his career.
But that was always in like
throw
that,
for throw, not statistically.
Yeah, yeah, that was always hyperbole, though. That, like, they're going to be bad. The point was just they're not going to be contending. Was always my point. It's like, it's not that Pittsburgh was never winning four games and like picking in the top 10. It's that in the division that now features Super Bowl contender Cleveland, perennial Super Bowl contender Baltimore, Pittsburgh probably is not in that group. They are going to win, you know, 7 to 9 games and be somewhere out of the playoff picture in the last couple of weeks. All of a sudden, they might make that like a three-way competition for the top of that division and fireworks.
I guess the point I would make is even when we were saying all those bad, like it was a bad offseason for Pittsburgh, I also kept saying, well, the what if for them to overcome this, they're going to have to, and I was half joking, well, maybe they drafted Najee Harris, and all of a sudden they're going to double their play action rate and all that stuff. And it's not necessarily because of Najee, but having Matt Canada there, right? And I wanted to see how Matt Canada meshed with Big Ben and the play action and the motion stuff. And those aren't cure-alls for everything. But the offense just looks different. And it looks like they will have enough misdirection. They will have enough play action to have a better run game this year with Najee. Not a force-fed run game, a better, more efficient run game, which is a part of what Pittsburgh needs to do. More importantly, they needed a more efficient pass game, which I think they'll do by a little bit of trickery, the play action stuff. And when you look at their playmaking situation, which is where I start with every offense, what's the quarterback and their playmaking situation? And is the offensive line good enough? I think they could protect the offensive line maybe enough. And then Claypool, Deontay Johnson, Juju, Freiermuth, and then Najee coming out of the backfield. I think there's a lot of potential there that it's going to be legitimately competitive in the AFC North with the Steelers, Ravens, and Browns.
The two things that are critical is, one, the biggest issue for them was the idea that their offensive line could be anything other than terrible based off the personnel and what they did and what they lost was almost, it was so far-fetched it was difficult to countenance earlier this offseason. Based off preseason, it actually looks like that line might be okay. Now, there's still going to be some problem spots, but all of a sudden, it's not going to be the thing that like cripples the entire team. It's going to be good enough that everything else can function. The other issue was, like you were making this point earlier in the offseason, that, hey, what if Ben Roethlisberger bounces back? And not bounces back, like all the way back to his ceiling.
In the range of outcomes there, right?
But like bounces back to being a good quarterback again. And, okay, it's been 10 dropbacks, right? So everything we just said about Jameis Winston and variance applies to Roethlisberger as well. But the 10 dropbacks did look different. Like, he looked more like old Ben Roethlisberger than he did last year when he was the first year back from that, you know, fairly major elbow reconstruction.
With older quarterbacks, especially like Brady now at 44, the only thing I really want to see from the old quarterbacks is, have they lost anything physically? So Brady gets out there the other night. He's zipping it around. Okay, so we're not going to see the Peyton arm strength this year. We're not going to see that decline. Same thing with Big Ben. You know, he's 1 year removed from the elbow surgery. He comes out. He's zipping it around a little bit. Okay, he's fine physically. Now, there's more to it. I think I mentioned last year, too, Drew Brees' decline, I think, showed up in actual velocity. I think it also shows up in just being rushed. You feel your mind is moving maybe a little bit quicker because you know you've got some other physical limitation as well. So that still remains to be seen with even a Brady, with a Roethlisberger and all that stuff. But even on 10 snaps, it's like, okay, is he okay physically? Looks good, yeah. Big Ben. So it's a good, encouraging start. And just like the Packers last year, I think the Packers had a bad offseason and they had a very good regular season. Do you want to touch on J.K. Dobbins a little bit? Or do you think, I mean, he's out. He's out for the season. Ravens likely starting running back. Gus Edwards comes in. Gus Edwards has averaged over 5 yards per carry in that offense in his career.
He'll be fine. I mean,
the Ravens always seem to be fine.
Yeah, well, particularly with the running backs. I mean, the run game is as good as it is because of Lamar Jackson.
Right.
Not because, like, not
Lamar Jackson, solid offensive line, good scheme. And the scheme is tied to Lamar.
Right, exactly. It's Lamar and the threat of what he does and the scheme and all those things open up lanes for running backs. So even, like, forget what Lamar brings in terms of actual production rushing the football. Just the threat that he poses on every single snap makes life easier for J.K. Dobbins and Gus Edwards and whoever it is that's going to be carrying the ball for them. And it was one of the reasons, like, You know, J.K. Dobbins looks like a fantastic running back. He's clearly got talent. He's physically gifted. Even, you know, a couple of snaps before he went down this week, he looked good. But pretty much everybody is going to look fine in that offense just because of what Lamar Jackson brings to it and the space that it creates for everybody. So Gus Edwards has been incredibly productive in this offense every time he's had the ball. I don't imagine that changing.
We'll get into some of the players who could get cut or traded, but I guess in this discussion, on my list of players who could potentially be available, your boy, Rashad Penny from the Seattle Seahawks. Josh Adams, currently with the Jets, playing with the Eagles. I've always just liked the way Josh Adams runs. Benny Snell could be out there. Boston Scott could be out there. I'm looking at guys that are just lower on the depth chart.
Made a great play.
Be available. Royce Freeman in Denver could be a fit for Baltimore. Peyton Barber. What about David Johnson in Houston? And we'll talk about Houston in a second. So if you're the Ravens and the running back carries the ball that many times, as smart as we say that the Ravens are and as much as we say never, ever draft a running back before round four, they did it with Dobbins, right? They felt like they needed to have a difference between the average running back. They felt like they needed to have an above average running back, clearly, by drafting Dobbins in round two. Will they make a move here to replace him? David Johnson would be intriguing.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting that they've always kind of gone with some kind of committee approach in this backfield. They haven't just loaded up one guy relentlessly and had him be like a 300 carry monster. So Gus Edwards is suddenly taking a lot of is obviously going to pick up the majority of the workload from J.K. Dobbins.
But he's not going to be a 300
carry
guy.
So the question is, do they trust, you know, Justice Hill to take that kind of role? Or do they want to upgrade on that position and have a guy that they're more comfortable with, sort of splitting work with Gus Edwards more evenly? There will be running backs available for them to do that. I don't know whether they want to dive into that. I maybe they don't need to.
Gus Edwards, 6'1", 238. I mean, and when they had him and Ingram, the couple bigger backs, Ingram was running 2 years ago because they just soured on him last year. And he's gotten older. Ingram was running mean. You know those angry runs that Brandt does on our competitor here, Good Morning Football. I mean, Mark Ingram, plus the downhill speed that you can hit the hole in that Ravens offense. I mean, I do believe they believe in that physicality, and I do wonder if they want bigger backs or if they want to complement it with speed backs. I'm always of the mind, if you have a good running game that puts guys in space, give me the speed guy. Give me the guy that runs 4.3.
Yeah.
Like Raheem Mostert in San Francisco. If you're going to put him in space as Kyle Shanahan, I want a guy taking it to the house. And a guy that could take it to the house would be a nice compliment to Gus Edwards there. But, losing Dobbins, certainly not ideal. He averaged 5.8 yards per carry in last year. And that's part of it, right? I mean, if they can grab any Gus Edwards undrafted free agent and have him average 5, I think they were saying, well, if you give us a Dobbins, we'll average almost 6.
Right.
And they almost did last year.
They have been, yeah.
There is value in upgrading your running back, and I'm curious to see if the Ravens end up doing something here and try to take a flyer on somebody.
Yeah, I mean, they're a prime candidate for, you know, waiting to cut day. Seeing what cut day produces.
Yeah.
It's Tuesday, right? Waiting to see what surfaces in cut day and then potentially claiming a running back to add to that group.
Imagine their running game is that good that it's like, yeah, this 5 yard per carry guy, that's our baseline.
Yeah, it would be interesting. It is interesting to see what style of running back they claim, if they claim one. Like, if they, like, another guy that might be available is Latavius Murray, who's been a starter when he's been given opportunities. The Saints seem to have soured on him generally. If he gets the open market, it would be a natural fit within that offense. But again, that skews more to the Gus Edwards style of bruising power back, the guy that's definitely going to guarantee you some yardage. Versus do they try and find a guy with that breakaway speed and somebody that can bring something different?
Ingram was a train wreck with his 4.2 yards per attempt last year in that offense.
Can't have it.
And they just said, nope, you're done, Mark Ingram. The baseline is 5 yards per attempt here in Baltimore. And it's kind of the truth. Jamar Chase dropped another pass, screen pass.
Which I think is his last 4 targets now have been dropped.
Does he have the yips, man? Does he have the
yips? Yeah. 4 straight drops, that's about as yip as it gets. This one was like, it was a wide receiver screen. And it, like, you know, so you make your move, hands up, like perfect technique. And it went through them and hit him in the face. Like he didn't even, it didn't even like hit the hands, then draw. Like it went through his hands.
To, like, make the diamond, right?
Well, that's what he did, except it went through the diamond, smacked him in the face cage.
He's not used to Joe Burrow's velocity.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's make more excuses for Jamar.
I mean, it's bad. Like that, yeah.
So do we have concerns? Like when John Ross was doing this, we were laughing at him, right? But this is Jamar Chase. He's supposed to be so much better than this. Are these concerns or just get him out of your system, kid?
I mean,
be a gamer.
It's concerning in that, you know, anytime a receiver drops four straight passes, it's not a good thing. But I mean, there's, I don't know what the reason for it is, but I can't imagine it being a long-term permanent problem. Like we've seen too much of Jamar Chase being really, really good for him to suddenly become a completely non-viable guy who can't catch the ball. So, all right, there's a bad run of it right now. It's not. So with Penei Sewell struggling, and obviously these two are linked forever, with Penei Sewell struggling, you can at least point to things that he's doing badly and say, all right, this is a thing that might take a while to work its way out, right? The fact that he's been moved from the left to the right side, his footwork isn't where it should be, his hand usage isn't where it should be, his like his punch on his strike on the defensive end, the pass rusher is not where it needs to be, and it's causing him problems like top to bottom. With Jamar Chase, you're not looking at this and you're like, well, everything he's doing here is wrong. It's like, I mean, that was just a pass that anybody catches and it hit him in the face. Like that's not a, well, I see your issue here is your route running is not up to snuff at the NFL level and that's causing you to be half a step behind and that's why the ball hit you in the head. No, like, this is just, it's something happened. He took his eye off the ball and it smacked him in the face. I would assume that isn't going to happen every single play.
Yeah. I wish he did more good things. I think.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Jamar.
I bet the Bengals wish that as well.
It'll be fascinating to watch Jamar Chase and Penei Sewell develop. The Sewell thing, like you said, there's a very specific excuse moving to right tackle. Even though others have done it, he's moving to right tackle. Looks very uncomfortable. You think he's going to get
one clear excuse. I mean, with all these guys, everybody is going to bring up the idea that, oh, they haven't played football in a year, right? But they're only going to bring those up for the ones that are bad. Like the guys that haven't played football for a year, and oh, by the way, it hasn't made any bit of difference whatsoever. You're not going to hear about it.
But a lot of those guys are defensive players. Micah Parsons is playing good football. Joe Tryon, Gregory Rousseau. Those are three of the opt-outs that I'm thinking of that were all on the defensive side. Caleb Farley opted out. He's been okay. But maybe it's just a defense versus offense thing. I don't know. It's just a small sample of stuff.
Yeah, I think it's just what you want to make the point. Like, if the guy's struggling, you're going to say, well, he hasn't played football.
And
if he's playing well, you're not going to mention it.
But the attackers, the defensive linemen and all that stuff seem to be doing okay. The guys that take a little bit more technique and precision, the offensive players who are, I don't know, maybe there's something to it.
You're just trying to read a pattern that isn't there.
I am.
This might be there, but it doesn't mean anything.
Listen, we've got Thursday and then a Monday show before we even get to our week one preview.
And Wednesday.
Don't forget we get the Wednesday show here too. So we're here on Monday morning. We're here on Wednesday. Look, the people are filling up here on the YouTube channel. Loving the Monday morning NFL podcast. I want to discuss the Texans. Okay. All right. Nobody leave. This will be a good discussion. It's going to be a good discussion about what the Texans are doing here. Purchasing draft picks. Okay, so we were sitting here because, you know, we love team building season. I'm ready for it already. I'm ready for free agency. I'm ready for the team. Season as it started, I'm ready for team building season. Do you ever do that? Do you ever play Madden franchise mode and you know, just kind of simulate? You do the offseason, you simulate the season, maybe play a game or two and just get to team building?
No.
You're missing out.
Okay.
Do you ever play the college football series?
Yeah, years ago.
I mean, that's what you do. You just recruit. You just recruit, simulate the season, recruit, just keep building that team.
Okay.
Made it to 2083 one time. What? It's a good summer, 2080. When you have a summer in Montana, you know, there's not much else going on. Sometimes you play.
You don't want to get out and see nature, no? Big sky?
No. Oh, 2083 is what you get to once the college football game gets out. You recruit, you simulate the season, you recruit again, you build a powerhouse. But the Texans, during team-building season, were like, what are they doing? They clearly have to rebuild. They brought in 900 free agents.
Yeah.
That were all – the Chris Conleys of the world, Desmond Kings of the world. Desmond Kings is fine, good player. Terrence Mitchell, Marcus Cannon. It is just all sorts of players who are just good, okay, solid players, short contracts. They're not a part of the big rebuild, but Shaq Lawson's one of the players that they brought in, and they just flipped him for a sixth-round pick, and they paid about $8 million for a signing bonus. The Jets get him for a sixth-rounder. The Jets are doing this because Carl Lawson got hurt, and the Jets aren't really mortgaging their future, just giving up a sixth for Shaq Lawson. What do you think of the Texans' strategy? I really think they got all these players, and at some point they're not going to be contenders, and some contender is going to be saying, we'll give you a fifth for Desmond King, we'll give you a sixth for Terrence Mitchell, we'll give you this for Marcus Cannon when we have an offensive line injury, and the Texans could rack up all this draft capital.
The Lawson one is one that doesn't make sense because they paid a lot for him. They've done it for the bunch of other guys, though, as well, that they've already flipped for low draft picks. Those make some sense because at that point you are legitimately just paying a little bit of cash for a low draft pick. Now, my concern is still, like, I still don't understand what the project is. Like, that in isolation is actually a smart thing to be doing. If you don't care about cash, which if you're a rich team and you have the money to spend, why would you, right? If you're prepared to essentially swap cash for draft picks, this is actually a really smart thing to do. Sign a whole bunch of guys in the offseason, stash them on the team, on the roster, for a couple of months of training camp, and then just before cut day, send 5, 6, 7, 10 of them to other teams for a bunch of low draft picks. And all of a sudden, you have double the number of picks you had in the upcoming draft, and all it cost you is a little bit of cash and some roster spots during training camp that you probably weren't going to use on anybody of consequence anyway. So from that point of view, actually, that makes a lot of sense. My whole point with the Texans, like from start to finish in this current regime, has been, okay, but like, what is the plan to fix this? Like, that makes sense, but it doesn't make any more sense than just signing like 25 guys that were intriguing at the bottom end of your roster anyway and seeing what sticks. Like, that, I was already okay with that as a concept. Like, sign a bunch of these guys, 3, 4, 5 of them will pan out, and all of a sudden you've got some interesting players, right?
And the other guys will trade for draft picks. That's an,
sure.
But that's not a bad strategy.
Agreed, but it wasn't a bad strategy before you factored in the draft pick element of it either. My point is simply, like, how are we fixing this? Like, where, you still have nothing at the top end of the roster, and that's the important part. All you're doing is, like, shuffling around the rubble that is the Houston Texans.
It has to be... It has to be a three-year deal. It has to be a three-year process. Because even, you mentioned this before, the playoff team, the Texans were a playoff team in 2019. Let's not forget.
Uh-huh.
They were also a playoff team that we were like, hey, it's Deshaun Watson's a good quarterback, and the offensive line's been better, and they had DeAndre Hopkins at the time, but man, this defense is just falling apart at the seams. And last year, it bottomed out. It was horrible. And the rest of the roster has just been getting worse and worse for the last 4 or 5 years. It's just the reality of what's happening in Houston. So it's probably going to take a few years to get it back. And I agree that you do it through draft capital. And even if it does feel like a sixth here and a sixth there, it's ammunition to move up, to move down. If you're smart, you start taking a sixth and you make it next year's fifth and you make that next year's fourth. And I'm not saying it's like 2027 before the Texans are better, but that stuff all adds up. It's like, okay, what else were you going to do in free agency? If they went and went 4 years, $20 million on, you know, name Joe Schmo defensive end, and then it's like, okay, I'm going to pay all this money for this defensive end who's going to be here for 2 years before I have to cut him during our rebuild, what's the point of that? They're at least getting something in free agency, which points to the draft, and then they just have to, you know, maneuver the draft properly here.
I just don't see a single thing that indicates that they are addressing the big picture. Like, I see a bunch of little small, like, they're doing all the things that, like, the Patriots typically do, right? Which is...
without Tom Brady at quarterback?
Right, which is, like, steal a tiny edge here and there in 5 different ways, and all of a sudden, you have a demonstrably better side than other people, because those edges add up, and in a game of inches, you know, what's the Al Pacino line? That's going to be the fucking difference between winning and losing, right? That's what they're doing, except they don't have the foundation. They don't have, like, the things that put you in that position. The edge that you achieve by racking up, like, 5 or 6 little small percentage points to make you better than the Ravens, right? That only matters if you were vaguely comparable to the Ravens to begin with. If the Ravens are already a 25-point favorite when you start off doing all this stuff, you didn't do anything. All you did is move 25-point favorite to 24-point favorite.
You got to start somewhere, Sam.
I made this analogy a bunch of times so far, but like the Texans, they're trying to build their own house, right? The whole thing is all they did, they found a nice piece of land overlooking a river, beautiful view. We're going to create this, our dream home on this thing, and then we're going to win a Super Bowl at the end of it, right? And so far, all they've done is create this like big muddy hole in the ground. There's nothing there yet. There's no foundation slab. There's no walls. There's no chimney. And all they're doing is going into meetings, like discussing the plaster work that's going to be on the ceiling and which color light fixtures are going to be in the bathrooms. It's like, dude, you haven't even put concrete in this muddy hole over here. That's the first thing you need to do, because otherwise none of this matters.
You should call my dad. He's a concrete guy.
Oh, yeah? You get your slab?
They don't know. They just don't know if they have their concrete guy yet, because their concrete guy
could
be really good, but there's 22 lawsuits out on him.
But they're
not my dad. The quarterback is the analogy I'm going for here.
They're not even like picking up the phone, calling around concrete guys, unless you think that's what like these trade rumors are.
How do you know? Again,
I'm just saying,
you're making assumptions.
There's no evidence that they are doing anything of substance to build this house.
They don't know what's going to happen with their quarterback.
That's the only thing of substance, is unless you're claiming that the entire master plan all along is to take the dude with 22 civil lawsuits hanging over his head and God knows how many criminal charges and flip him for all of the draft picks, and all of a sudden you've got something to create a foundation with.
I mean, if anything, they're holding out as long as they can to max – they're trying to at least maximize that value. They're probably putting feelers out there saying, hey, the Dolphins are close. Hello, Panthers. Hey, Panthers, did you hear that? The Dolphins are close.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened this weekend. There was a lot of rumors that the Dolphins were done. They were going to make the deal. They're obviously denying it.
The rumors are nuts. The rumors are 3 first-round draft picks, 2 second-round draft picks for a guy who might be in jail in 6 months' time.
And Bert Breer was reporting, too, in his
– But don't worry, we'll have pick protection. What the hell even is that?
It would be all conditional. It would have to be all conditional.
We will trade you our next 2 drafts on the condition that he isn't in jail.
But that's why if you're the Texans, you're almost better off just holding on to him. You're really better off just holding on to him at that point. Because if you got 3 conditional first and 2 conditional seconds, say,
yeah,
and they're all based off of playing time, and then who knows what happens there, then you didn't get anything.
Yeah.
If you hold on to him, there's a chance you either get nothing because, you know, bad stuff happened and he's at fault, and that, or he gets through all of it somehow and is, you know, an NFL player who's not suspended at some point, and some team's going to really want him and you get your value then. So I just don't know. The Texans, I mean, the other answer was they should have just traded him in February before any of the stuff happened. But they were hopeful because it's not easy, man. Like, before the Chargers showed up, it wasn't an easy decision for the Texans, other than they were at odds and, you know, Deshaun Watson didn't want to play there. But they felt like they could talk him back into it. And who the heck wants to trade him when you have to then spend those 5 picks you got to try to find another capable quarterback like him?
Yeah. I mean,
it's a tough situation for the Texans, having the worst roster and now the worst off-field situation for a quarterback and having to stitch it all together.
The bottom line,
that's why they just wanted to end training camp, man. They were just trying to quit training camp a few weeks ago, and the NFL wouldn't let them.
I know. It's a mean NFL.
All I wanted to talk about is the fact that they went from an offseason that I didn't understand, that you were like, oh, I kind of get it, I didn't really understand it, to if the strategy was to accumulate all these veteran players, flip them all for draft picks, I'm a little intrigued by that particular move in this Texans rebuild.
I just don't see that that's changed anything from a month and a half ago where you didn't see that element of it. I mean, yeah, like that part was never something that I disagreed with. Like, they threw a ton of darts at the board and they were probably going to hit on some guys. And okay, now you add in the extra element of, hey, and the guys we didn't hit in, we might be able to trade away for some 6th-round picks. Like, okay, but even if you accumulate the entire 6th round in next year's draft, what the hell are you going to do with that? That's not going to move you anywhere.
The value of a 5th and 6th round pick is fascinating to me, because if you make the actual picks, you don't get a whole bunch of high-quality players.
So you use the 6th round.
But if you were a team that's close to contending, yeah, or
which they're not. Like, what they can take all those 6-round picks that they just accumulated from all the veterans that they traded away and spend them on veterans that other teams are trying to trade away.
But if you take four, if you have 4 6th-round picks, you might get one out of those six. All I'm saying is the value of a 6th-round pick is pretty good if you're a team like the Ravens that all of a sudden flips one for Calais Campbell and or even the Jets. I mean, the 6th-round pick can net you a Shaq Lawson, who's a good, solid rotational defensive end.
Right.
Potential starting defensive end.
Which is why other teams are trying to acquire them.
But it's fine. The Texans can accumulate them and continue to push them down the road, and then they start flipping them for the veteran players when they want them on the team. They don't need the veteran players on their team right now because they're not going to win this year. I'm intrigued. Color me intrigued.
Yeah.
All right, let's wrap this up with some of the potential cuts and trades. And Shaq Lawson was on my list, and look at him. Ends up getting traded. Really quick, I want to touch on – you watched Tyler Huntley back up for the Ravens this weekend pretty closely. And then Malik Taylor, the wide receiver for the Packers. I just want to highlight a couple players who just balled out this preseason. Malik Taylor, 6'2", 215-pound wide receiver for the Packers, looks like a guy who could legitimately compete for targets as opposite Davante Adams. Incredible ball skills, size, the type of runs the vertical route tree pretty well. He's the type of guy I think that could emerge and Aaron Rodgers would like. I know he likes Alan Lazard, but if he could be competing with Alan Lazard, and I think he'll make the roster in Green Bay and is just an intriguing player at the moment.
I just ran the numbers, by the way, using the Jimmy Johnson trade chart. If you traded every single pick in the 6th round, you could get number 32 overall.
See what I'm saying? See what I'm saying?
All you need to do is trade, 30-something picks. All of them. You package that up. Send it to the Bucks. You get number 32.
All right, you've lost time on Tyler Huntley. I also promised 2 QB systems. Let's discuss two QB systems.
That's Tyler Huntley looked amazing, like absolutely incredible.
We're on the different pages.
Well, here. I just want to actually.
All right, touch on Tyler Huntley.
He looked insane. I mean, this idea of will the NFL figure out Lamar Jackson? If they do, you're okay because Tyler Huntley looked incredible. Now, look, it's the perfect example of it's preseason and one game can tell you anything. That's as good a game as anybody has played this preseason in its entirety, and he got almost all of it. Does that mean that Tyler Huntley is that guy all the time? No, probably not. He's going to make some mistakes. He's going to have some bad plays that weren't there this time. But the high-end stuff is incredible, and he's a perfect Lamar Jackson backup because he's one of the few players in the NFL that's at least in the vicinity of where Lamar Jackson is in terms of athleticism spectrum. Like, he isn't Lamar Jackson. He's probably a couple of tenths slower in the 40. He's not quite as dynamic as in terms of moves and space. But he's big. He's fast. He's, athletic. He's got a good arm. I mean, he looked like a fantastic player in that game.
He finished he had a solid career at Utah. And then his last year, 90 overall PFF grade, 89 passing grade. I don't think his arm's great.
Looked pretty good.
But he had touch throws that he was making and everything. I mean, Huntley might be a find. And it was another one of those things where the grading was solid in college and it looked good. And maybe that's, the guy you want to take a flyer on in the late rounds at the Ravens. It may have paid off for the Ravens.
He's been forced into action a couple of times for Baltimore, like in the regular season so far, and has looked good. I mean, he looks like a very good backup, particularly for them.
So that's our intriguing player part of the podcast. Malik Taylor, wide receiver for the Packers for me. Tyler Huntley for you.
Done.
QB for the Ravens.
Easy.
Let's discuss 2 QB systems, then we'll get into some of the trade and cut candidates. Could this be a legitimate thing?
Yeah. I told you this last week.
Yeah, but you said it. You went this – you guys got to go listen to this theory that Sam had. He thinks he's going to roll in to the Broncos meeting and say, Teddy, we're playing a bad team this week. Teddy Bridgewater, you're the starter. We're playing the Chiefs. Drew Lock, we need you because you're just crazy. Sometimes you do crazy stuff, and sometimes it's really good, and we're hoping for the really good stuff. Go beat the Chiefs this week, Drew Lock. That's your version of the 2 QB system.
No, you are conflating two separate things that I said in last week's show.
That's what I heard.
I said, one, that Denver, since they don't actually have a good quarterback, might be best suited using their two very different stylistic quarterbacks and alternating them on a week-to-week basis, depending on the opposition. If they're playing garbage, you put Teddy out there because he's the least likely to screw it up. If you're playing a team where you're overmatched, like the Chiefs, you put Drew Lock out there because at least the upside is he goes on a run of high variance, doesn't have mistakes, and he's at least capable, potentially, of going toe-to-toe with a better team in a way that Teddy probably isn't. I wouldn't sell it as, hey, you're starting this week because we're playing a really crappy team and we think you're the best person to not screw it up. I would find a better way of dressing that up. But that's the opinion.
Good luck with that.
My other point was, I think my prediction was that at some point this year, an NFL team is going to legitimately use some form of two quarterback system, like in a way that is beyond just the Taysom Hill package for a couple of gimmick plays every game.
Now that one, you might be right.
Right. And right on the heels of that, we have the 49ers running effectively a two-quarterback system in their final preseason game.
Yeah, my argument for the going back to the Trey Lance, Mac Jones thing, my argument for Trey Lance is Kyle Shanahan gets to add a massive element to his run game, which is already incredible.
Mm-hmm.
He's already an outside zone genius. He added gap schemes to his arsenal for the first time in his career in 2019, like actually running power and counter and backside pullers and things that they just didn't do before. It was always outside zone, got to live it, breathe it. Now you kind of go back to when he had RG3. Okay, you had the quarterback element. Again, the run game is all about winning. It's about angles that Shanahan always talks about, but it's about box count and winning the math. A running quarterback allows you to do that. Trey Lance allows you to do that. He is a weapon on the goal line because of that. And of course, he's not just a runner. He can throw too. So yeah, I can see the Niners absolutely tapping into that early on in the season. I think a big part of it, though, is we have 35, maybe more, legitimate starters in today's NFL. Somebody in the YouTube comments just mentioned Taylor Heinicke. I mean, Taylor Heinicke could be a legitimate starter in the NFL. We don't know yet, but the Patriots could be sitting there with Mac Jones and Cam Newton. Is Cam Newton ready to be a backup quarterback in the NFL? I don't think so. But Mac Jones, Cam Newton, Trey Lance, Jimmy Garoppolo. Garoppolo's not a backup in the NFL. He's a starting caliber quarterback. Justin Fields, Andy Dalton. I mean, maybe it's time for Andy Dalton to be a backup. Yeah. But there are enough starting caliber quarterbacks, and I am fascinated to see. And then we've got, you know, Tamus, of course, a legitimate two QB system. I think you're right. We might see it.
But the other thing is, there's so many different styles of these quarterbacks. So even if you have two guys that are vaguely similar in terms of like overall quality, you know, each one of these guys is going to spit out a 65 PFF grade. Okay, but is there a scenario whereby they're good at different things and some combination of the two of them creates a grade that's better than 65? You know, so that's my rough suggestion in terms of Denver, but it's on a week-to-week basis. But what about in the same game? Like if you have Jimmy Garoppolo and Trey Lance, who are very different stylistically, is there a combination of the two of them where you get better than the sum of the parts, right? Just playing both of them at the same time causes defenses enough problems that you maximize what they're good at and hide the things that they're not great at. And that's the thing, Cam Newton and Mac Jones is similar as well. Even if you put Mac Jones in as the starter, there are areas where Cam Newton is going to be more beneficial. Like if I'm facing a third and two, I would prefer Cam Newton to be out there because he brings things that you have to defend that Mac Jones doesn't.
Right. And that stuff goes beyond the grade. I mean, that goes beyond, like, as much as the PFF grade, I think, is the biggest driver of team performance and all that stuff. Again, just PFF grade doesn't account for changing the math in the box and all that stuff, or putting the defense in a bind and saying, hey, third and two, Cam Newton's on the field, and we've got a massive offensive line and these running backs, and we've got all these different options. So I am intrigued by that. Let me just paint a quick picture here, too. Last year, there were 22 quarterbacks who had a PFF passing grade of 70 or better. So that's in the green. It's 68, 67 is about average. So a lot of players above average from a passing standpoint. Some of the guys who ranked below average include Ben Roethlisberger, Cam Newton, Teddy Bridgewater, Drew Lock, we mentioned. Minshew was below average. Carson Wentz. All of those guys have been better than that, though, at some point in their career. And I'm not saying it all comes to a head, but we really might be at this point, just painting a picture here. What if there were 28 NFL quarterbacks that could grade 70 or better from a PFF grading standpoint? Like, they're all capable. I don't think we've been in this world before. So if you are a guy that, if 70 used to be good and solid. Now, if you're at that level, you're one of the worst in the NFL just by the way the league is going. So you're creating that advantage, either with a second quarterback or with the run game or whatever it might be, is something teams have to look at.
Yeah, and I think there's different ways of achieving it as well. Like, you know, the most obvious one is the Cam Newton, Mac Jones thing, where Cam Newton becomes like a devastating goal line, short yardage type of thing that you have to defend, or the Trey Lance, Jimmy Garoppolo thing. But there's also, like, how do you, in the past, NFL teams have used like red zone quarterbacks, where, you know, they've had one guy take it between the 20s and then another guy comes in for the red zone. And interestingly, teams have done it, I think, in opposite ways. Like, the red zone has been used, Bill Walsh used the red zone as sort of the easy part. You know, you bring in, that's when you ease in Joe Montana, right? You get somebody else to get you to the 20, and then Montana comes in where it's easier.
Starting to question Bill Walsh's genius.
Right. Montana comes in where it's somehow easier and throws a touchdown, and that's how you ease him into the game. And other teams have done it the other way, where actually the hardest part is when you get to the red zone, everything's condensed and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So we have like the bad quarterback, quote unquote, between the 20s. Once we get there, just to make sure he doesn't screw it up, we throw out Kurt Warner. And Kurt Warner can go in there and make sure he doesn't turn it over. So there's the idea of like red zone versus not. Or there's just, do you alternate? Like, is there a scenario where you can go like quarter by quarter or drive by drive and just give a defense something different to look at every single time they show up? I think there's mileage to the idea of, look, the idea before is if you have two quarterbacks, you have none. I don't think that's true anymore. Like, it might be that if you have two quarterbacks, neither of them are great, you're not obviously you're in a worse situation than a team that has one really good one, but there might be a way, there's an element of things you can do with two quarterbacks that you can't with the one that might actually help you. Like, you know, you hear all the time about how we're not going to name the starter this week because that way the defense can't prepare for that one guy. They've got to prepare for both and it wastes their time. What if every week is that week? Not only do you have to prepare for both these guys, but you have to expect it in every single game because we're just going to alternate them. We know that neither one of these guys is amazing, but we're going to make your life more miserable by having to deal with both of them.
My one counter to that, though, and that is a thing, right? You put the defense in a bind, and yeah, preparing for Jimmy Garoppolo plus Trey Lance is difficult. You still have to practice that, right? So you still have to give Garoppolo enough reps and give Trey Lance enough reps to make that work on your end, too. So it's not just the defense preparing. It's you also preparing. You have to take time to do that as well. People forget that.
Yeah, but the sort of – it doesn't matter. Like, taking
a little bit. Yeah.
Well, taking reps away from like an unquestioned really good starter is probably not great. Taking reps away from a guy that you're not loving his ability anyway, I'm less concerned about taking his reps away.
All right, let's
if
wrap
I valued
it up.
His reps, it wouldn't be a two quarterback conversation anyway.
Let's wrap it up with some players who could be on the move. On my list is Breshad Perriman, Lions wide receiver, just got released this morning. He's a couple years removed from that really intriguing season, former first-round pick with size and speed and had drop issues, but resolved them. And if there was ever a team that could use a receiver, it'd be the Lions, and they just released Breshad Perriman. That might be the worst indictment of him at this point. He was only worth $2.5 million.
And they paid $2 million, like, guaranteed. Like, they'd already sunk the money into him and still right. decided it wasn't worth it.
So not sure exactly what happened there. We mentioned the three tight ends, Zach Ertz in Philadelphia, Hayden Hurst in Atlanta, and O.J. Howard in Tampa Bay. Maybe Cameron Brate in Tampa Bay. I don't know. But O.J. Howard seems like he could be the odd man out in Tampa Bay. They could also just roll into the season with three legitimate tight ends and one intriguing upside tight end that's on the roster as well. But yeah, for teams, there are a lot of tight end needy teams around the NFL. I think Jacksonville is certainly one of them. They would be a potential landing spot for Ertz, Hayden Hurst, or O.J. Howard if they are available, due to depth chart situations, or just Ertz being older and Eagles being in rebuilding mode.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like the Eagles are particularly keen on getting rid of Zach Ertz. Seems like they're happy enough with him being there, and he was one of the most talked about trade candidates earlier in the offseason, and then that all kind of disappeared, and all of a sudden he's just stuck there. I suspect he would be fine with getting out of Philadelphia, but they seem to be perfectly content with having two of those tight ends and knowing that Jalen Hurts is going to be targeting tight ends a lot, and it actually behooves them to have both Goddard and Ertz on the roster. O.J. Howard is the intriguing one, though, because obviously the injury last year kept him out of that the whole season almost. He's been back in preseason, looks a little bit rusty. Maybe, I mean, you would assume he's the lowest guy on the totem pole just because of all that, but is still the guy with the most pedigree in terms of first-round talent, the best athlete of the group, and certainly has a ton of upside for a team that doesn't have a good tight end situation if he becomes available.
Yeah, and last year when O.J. Howard, before he got hurt, Antonio Brown wasn't on the team. So when you looked at their roster last year, it was like, oh, they have Mike Evans and Chris Godwin, and yeah, Scotty Miller's out there at receiver. But you would say, okay, you have O.J. Howard and Gronk and Brate. Those are your playmakers. Now, you know Tampa Bay is going to be wanting to run three wide receivers a lot with that top trio. You know Gronk is going to see his time. Mm-hmm. Cameron Brate has been as solid and dependable as Howard, even if the upside, quote-unquote upside, might not be there. So, yeah, it's just going to be tough to get everybody snaps there.
Yeah.
And Scotty Miller is still going to run, you know, 10 deep routes a game as well. So there's just a lot of footballs to go around in Tampa Bay. A couple of our favorite receivers, Tim Patrick for me at the Denver Broncos, Denzel Mims playing pretty well for the Jets. Grade-wise, Mims is up there. Do you think he's available in year two here? Again, I just made this list of guys who either you've got a new regime and they're in year two, rumors, or they're just not high up on the depth chart, or they're hitting free agency, whatever it is. But again, if I'm a receiver needy team, I'm thinking about Tim Patrick. And if the Jets are soured on Denzel Mims, I'm thinking about him as well.
Yeah, I don't really know what to make about the Denzel Mims thing. I mean, they buried him on the depth chart. He's been dealing with injuries. He did then play really well when he had preseason game time. I don't know. He's definitely, like, if I was a team with a desperate need at wide receiver, I'd certainly be calling the Jets up and inquiring. I would also wouldn't be in the least bit surprised if that inquiry resulted in like an immediate shutdown. And they're like, no, he's still, yeah, you know, still a valuable part of this team. It just hasn't worked out yet. Tim Patrick is the one, though, where you look at that and say, like, even if they like him, it's a real luxury for Denver to carry him on the roster, knowing that he's basically not going to be a factor in this offense if everything else works out fine. Cortland Sutton, Jerry Jeudy, KJ Hamler.
Do you run four wide a bunch?
No, I don't think you're going to run four wide a bunch, but he becomes your contingency. Like, what happens if the Cortland Sutton thing goes down again? Like, there's value in that, but is it more valuable than the pick you could get by trading him away?
Andre Dillard, former first-round offensive tackle for the Eagles. A lot of rumors about him potentially being a trade candidate. It is a crazy story. Jordan Mailata, the former Australian rugby player, has emerged as the starting left tackle candidate with the Eagles. Now, he played all of last year. Mailata had one of the highest percentage of positively graded run blocks, highest percentage of negatively graded run blocks. But you can see he can absolutely move people. And for a guy that just, this is where you can almost expect linear development, right? A guy who's so young and new at football, picked it up early, and he has legitimately continued to get better, and he's probably going to win the starting spot, puts Dillard out on the trading block.
Yeah, he looks good. I mean, Mailata was always kind of intriguing when he, I mean, not just because of the story, but when he first started getting game time. It's like, all right, this isn't bad. Like, there's a lot of these guys where the story is incredible, and they get on the field, and they're like, yeah, I mean, just, it's a big stretch to imagine this guy actually achieving anything, but from day one, like, Mailata has actually flashed the ability to do this and has continued to get consistently better, eliminate the bad, and all of a sudden looks like he could be like a pretty good starting tackle, left tackle.
And Dillard, his question mark, coming out of Washington State, spread Mike Leach offense, hasn't been a great run blocker, has not taken to that. So I don't know how many teams are looking for a guy who's better in pass pro and hasn't necessarily been elite there when he's had a chance on the field. Couple defensive players, both Cowboys linebackers, Jalen Smith, Leighton Vander Esch. Are those guys both available given Micah Parsons, Jabril Cox investment, Keanu Neal coming in there? If you're a linebacker needy team, are you calling about Jalen Smith? Are you calling about Leighton, especially Vander Esch?
Yeah.
Right? He's had those injuries, but man, he looked like he was ready to become one of those, you know, perennial top five linebackers a couple years ago.
Yeah, I mean, he was the best of that group that his rookie year. In terms of, like, performance, he looked like the guy that was going to be the best player right away. then got injured and hasn't really been the same guy since. The thing that would make him more intriguing, though, than Jalen Smith is the contract. Like, Leighton Vander Esch is still on, you know, the four-year, $12 million deal as opposed to the monster extension that Jalen Smith got. If both those guys have fallen by the wayside and are backups and are available, like, one of them is coming with a monster deal. Like, you're committing not just, let's see if this guy, let's kick the tires and see if there's a reclamation to be had. One of them is, let's kick the tires and it's going to be expensive as hell. The other one is much more, like, intriguing in terms of value. I definitely would be taking a look at a guy like Leighton Vander Esch if he's available.
One other name I want to mention defensively, Juan Thornhill, heading into year three with the Kansas City Chiefs. He had a really nice rookie season, kind of took a step back last year. He's been playing fourth quarter for the Chiefs. Very rare for a guy, second round pick with that pedigree, with a track record of success, at least at one point, 77 career coverage grade. Not sure what's happening with Juan Thornhill, but if he's available and your team needs a safety, probably picking up the phone, looking at Thornhill. Better free safety than anything. Had some tackling issues.
Would you be intrigued if you're a team that already has a good receiving group with potentially grabbing N'Keal Harry? So N'Keal Harry has been an unmitigated disaster so far for the Patriots. Total bust. Can't get open. Can't separate. Started to drop passes that, you know, you're supposed to be a contested catch guy. But he's big and has run after the catch skills. And if you can scheme him open, can obviously make some plays along with, you know, everybody else in the NFL. But like, if you have already a number one receiver and, you know, a number two target that you're comfortable in, and have sort of room in the offense for a guy that we can feed bubble screens to, or like the manufactured targets for receivers to just get the ball in his hands with some room to run after the catch.
Yes.
I think that's where he can actually still do damage. He just can't like manufacture his own yardage.
Yeah, the thing about Harry, even when he was drafted by the Patriots, I said, because remember at the time they had the worst tight end situation, they lost Gronk. I said, make him a big slot, let him run the seam and use his body in the middle, and then feed him targets. If the question is N'Keal Harry a decent number four? Yes, he's a decent number four. So I think if you have a good top three, like if you're Arizona, just throwing a team out, because Christian Kirk could be available. If you're Arizona and you run as many screens as you run.
But they would have been perfect like last year, right?
Now, I know they got Rondell
right,
now
Rondell, that but that's the role I'm talking about, right? If you're going to force feed Larry Fitzgerald those plays just to get the ball in his hands because he's such a legend for you, like you could, if you could force feed N'Keal Harry those targets, like that's a guy with some actual run after the catch skills and the ability to break tackles and make people look ridiculous. So, you know, like I wouldn't want him being part of my top two rotation or even as a third guy. But if you have that role within your offense, like if you have a specific spot for guy to get those force-fed manufactured targets, I still think he has a useful skill set for that.
Miami, maybe? Miami's got a top three. They got speed.
Presumably, they would give those to, like, Jalen Waddle or Jakeem Grant.
The point is, there's not a whole lot of these options. And if you're investing in N'Keal Harry to be a two or a three, it's risky. But as a screen guy, certainly some potential there. So, anyway, we'll have a lot more on Thursday. There's going to be a lot of moves between now and Wednesday. Sorry, we got a Wednesday show and then Thursday. So Wednesday, Mike Renner is going to be on our midweek show. Remember, we added the third show. And then Thursday, we'll have a lot of reaction to the cuts and the moves, and there'll be plenty of news to discuss on Thursday. So that'll do it for us. Don't forget, kickoff 30, kickoff 30 over at pff.com. 30% off any of your PFF subscriptions. Thanks to everybody for tuning in. We'll see you Wednesday.